Thanks very much, Garth, for the introduction, and thank you to everybody who've stayed on for what is either the first or second rearranged time, depending on which you were told, and still being here in the rain, although that seems mainly to be me. I could come closer. I'll sit it out for now. Garth is going to try and distribute handouts, which you don't really have to look at for the talk itself. But it's there's always one. But it's more for you to take home. It's just a couple of maps, and on one side there is a section called 10 Facts About the Palestinian Citizens of Israel, which is just taken straight from the back of my second book. But anyway, it should make sense. Though in the time for questions, if there's something on the sheet that doesn't make sense, if you've had time to look at it when I've started to become a bit boring, then you can ask me in the Q&A, to clarify something. Okay, so the title of the talk is Palestine, Israel, Moving from Separation and Exclusion to Sharing and Equality. I was initially prepared to do it with PowerPoint and fancy things like that, but obviously I'm not doing that now. So you're just going to have to bear with me to see how it goes talking to you like this. I'm dividing the talk into a few different sections. And the first section that I'm going to start with, for the reason that it's impossible to have an appropriate analysis of what's happening in Palestine, Israel, or what could happen there, without beginning with the status quo. Okay, without beginning with a realistic assessment of what is happening there now. Not an assessment that shies away from some ugly realities, and also an assessment that takes into account things that aren't widely known as well. So the first part, I'm just going to kind of go through a few aspects of the status quo to kind of set the scene, as it were, and also begin to provide the kind of framework that I think it's best to look at Palestine, Israel. The first thing that I want to say about the status quo is that what we've got now is a de facto one state. Okay? So even before talking about whether there should be two states or one state or a million states, what there is now is one state or one regime, in the sense that the Israeli state, the Israeli government, is the sovereign power from the Mediterranean Sea to the Jordan River. Okay, over the whole area of Mandate Palestine, over the whole area of Israel, the occupied Palestinian territories, there is only one real sovereign. On that basis, you then look within that regime and you see that Palestinians who live under that regime are subjected to policies that conform with the definitions of apartheid, ethnic cleansing, and discrimination. But it's not the same for every Palestinian under that regime, because there are different legal kind of rights or denial of rights depending on where the Palestinian is and whether, for example, the Palestinian has citizenship. Okay, so even though Israel is the one regime in the whole area and Palestinians are subjected to various discriminatory policies, it's better, if you will have it like that, it's better if you're a Palestinian with Israeli citizenship in Nazareth compared to if you're a Palestinian without citizenship living under military occupation in Ramallah, okay? And living in Ramallah is better than if you're a Palestinian in the Jordan Valley, okay, et cetera, et cetera. And you can look at a lot of different subdivisions like that. But the key point to bear in mind is that you're looking at a single regime under which people are afforded or denied different rights on an ethno-religious basis, okay? To flesh that out with some specifics in a few categories, okay? Starting off with the Palestinian citizens of Israel, or so-called Israeli Arabs, to give you just again a kind of snapshot of some of the discrimination that they experience. Some of this stuff is on the one side of your sheet. Since 1948, there's been about 700 new communities, towns, established for Jewish Israelis. And none, with the exception of about half a dozen that were made for Bedouin Arabs in the Negev in the south, And the only reason they were made in the first place was as part of a deliberate move to relocate and concentrate the Bedouin Arab population in one part of the Negev. Another example, you can, if you're a citizen of Israel, and this obviously only really affects the Palestinians, it's illegal for you to live with your spouse in the country if your spouse is a Palestinian from the West Bank or Gaza. Okay? That was a law that was brought before the Israeli High Court of Justice, and the High Court of Justice ruled in favor of the law on the basis that, quote, human rights is not an excuse for national suicide. Okay, so the reason why those spouses and families are separated, legally speaking, is because the motivation being that they don't, the Israeli state doesn't want to bring in more Palestinians through marriage. Another example, there are many Palestinian citizens who live in unrecognized villages, which I imagine many of you may have heard of because it's started to be an issue that's discussed more, about 90,000. And many of those are concentrated in the Negev, in the south, although there are also some in the center and the north. And currently, the Israeli government is moving forward with a plan that threatens the existence of many of those communities and means that around 40,000 citizens will be forcibly removed from their villages, the villages destroyed, in the name of developing the Negev and this idea that you want the Bedouin concentrated in one sector only. Discrimination runs through the budgets in terms of the education ministry, and the list goes on. One more example: about 70% of Israeli communities are quite small rural communities, and to be a resident of those communities, you have to be accepted by a so-called admissions committee, and that admissions committee can deny a person the ability to live there if they are not suitable for the social fabric of the community. Now that discriminates against a lot of people, but it's primarily designed to discriminate against the Palestinian citizens, not least because many of those communities have been built on the confiscated property of Palestinian villages that are either not there anymore or that are there but have had their land reduced. Okay, so that's just a snapshot, and bear in mind, everything that I've just mentioned is kind of like, you know, the better side of the regime between the river and the sea, because they've at least got citizenship and some rights. Then you look at maybe the situation in East Jerusalem, where Palestinians have just got residency status, which is neither citizenship, but also they're not quite as screwed as those in the West Bank and Gaza. And in East Jerusalem, then the Israeli regime there is pursuing policies such as denying Palestinians permits to build, while obviously allowing growth of Israeli settlements there, home demolitions. Palestinians who have only got residency rights can have that permission to live in their own city taken away from them. And the EU, which mainly does good reports but then carries on treating Israel as if everything was fine, but these reports talk about that policy of taking away the permission as being based on demographic considerations. Okay, so you know what demographic considerations is a polite way of saying. And they don't even need to be subtle about it, because the current mayor of Jerusalem, Nir Barkat, when he was interviewed on BBC Hard Talk, I forget when it was, maybe I think it was about a year ago, the guy doing Hard Talk said to him, "So do you believe that there is a certain ethnic ratio that you need to maintain in the city?" And he had no shame about saying yes. Okay, so the mayor of the of what Israel says is his capital city doesn't feel shy to say that actually, in terms of policy, there's a particular ratio of Jews and Palestinians that they need to keep in the city. Looking at the West Bank now, so Palestinians living under military occupation. Of course, since 67, parts of the West Bank have been eaten up by different methods of colonization, whether you're talking about civilian settlement colonies, whether you're talking about areas of land that are off limits because the IDF, the Israeli army, uses it for training purposes, whether you're talking about a road network that has different discriminatory measures about who can travel and when not, whether you're talking about the apartheid wall, obviously. Again, I'm just kind of running through these very briefly because I'm assuming, A, that many of you know these things, and it's just really kind of to set things up for how stuff looks right now. And the Gaza Strip, of course, which to some extent doesn't get the same attention, at least in my experience, or certainly my feeling is, that it doesn't get the same attention as it now as it did maybe a couple of years ago. Now, some of this is for obvious reasons. I mean, initially Gaza was on everybody's mind because of the massacres of 2008, 2009, so-called Operation Cast Lead. And also before that, and since then, the siege and the blockade. But there's something very important that's happening with Gaza that people need to keep up with, which is that Israeli policies there and also the regional changes, particularly what's happening in Egypt, is sort of kind of shifting the dynamic in Gaza too. It's no longer really adequate to talk about Gaza just in terms of siege or blockade, okay? Because, for example, individual people have now got an easier crossing in and out through Rafah, okay, into in and out of Egypt. What's more important, I think, or at least as equally important, is to talk about how Israel has deliberately separated the Gaza Strip from the West Bank, two bits of territory that under Oslo are meant to be part of the, quote, same territorial unit. But the Israeli officials in documents and in positions before the court call it their, quote, separation policy for political reasons to divide Gaza and the West Bank. So it means that if you're a student from Gaza and you want to study in a West Bank university, it's almost impossible to be able to do that. So that separation policy is very important. And while the Israeli government and the Israeli army insist that goods can come into Gaza freely, you know, they show pictures of full marketplaces and what have you, what they don't tell you is that the ability for the Gaza Strip economy to export goods is almost zero. And that is a deliberate Israeli policy again, because before 2005, 2006, most goods out of Gaza were exported to for consumption in Israel and the West Bank. The vast majority, I think it's about 80%, were going there. That market is effectively closed completely. So it's a very artificial kind of situation in Gaza where goods come in, but nothing really can go out. So that is just a kind of a summary that I rattled through fairly quickly there to flesh out what I'm talking about by that one regime. All those Palestinians living in that one regime are being discriminated against, subjected to different policies of segregation, separation, and ethnic cleansing in some cases. And it's the same sovereign in charge. Okay, so that is what I wanted to kind of just set up. Now, the second thing that I wanted to talk about, I call it the two-state solution, or is it the two-state illusion? It's quite interesting and a bit ironic that a lot of people have learned about Palestine in the last few years and come to understand the need for a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza at around about the time when it's become impossible for this to happen. Now, I want to say a couple of things about this idea of the two-state illusion. And I mean, just to be explicit about it, you'll get this as I talk anyway, but just to be explicit about it, I don't personally believe that a two-state solution is correct or even viable, and I believe in a kind of some form of one-state solution. But I just wanted to say two things about the two-state illusion. It's now become very common, and in fact, you can find this going right back to the 80s, which shows you like how nobody cared about trying to stop this. It's very common now for people to say that it's impossible for a Palestinian state to emerge because of Israeli policies, right? I'm sure you might have heard some variation of that, that because of Israeli settlements in the West Bank, there's no room left for a Palestinian state, that sort of thing, yeah? That's true, okay? It's true that Israeli policies and Israeli colonization strategies have been deliberately designed to make sure that an independent Palestinian entity, it's impossible to emerge. I mean, you might think, for example, that someone like Yitzhak Rabin, the martyr of the Israeli peace camp, so-called peace camp, at least he maybe believed in the two-state solution. But if you go back and see what Rabin was saying at the time, including in his Knesset address not long before he was assassinated, he made it quite clear to the Israeli public and to Israeli politicians that what he was looking for, in his own words, was an entity that would be less than a state. And he talked about Jerusalem being the united, undivided capital of Israel. He talked about Israel keeping the main colony blocks like Ma'ale Adumim, Ariel, Gush Etzion, the Jordan Valley, etc. So, yeah, Israeli policies and Israeli governments of all different kinds have made sure that their policies make it impossible to make a Palestinian state. But I want to say that arguing against the two states or discussing this subject, it's not just good enough, I don't think, to say that it's not possible practically speaking, as if it was practically possible that it would be the best. No, I want to say that actually one should object to the two-state solution, especially now, because it's not the best. And because what does it say to Palestinians living in Israel, Palestinian citizens who are discriminated against in the so-called Jewish and democratic state? And what does it say for the Palestinian refugees who actually make up the majority of the Palestinian people? Okay, the majority of Palestinians don't even live in Palestine, Israel. They don't live directly under Israeli control. They're not allowed to go back. Okay, so the two-state solution framework, and if anybody wants to go into the Q&A of how it kind of, you know, emerged and anything to do with that, fine. I won't go into details of that now. But the two-state solution framework has always been problematic from the point of view of Palestinians living inside Israel and from the point of view of the Palestinian refugees too. And the final point I want to make about the two-state solution or two-state illusion is that speaking in 2012 about this topic, I think it's safe to say that advocating or supporting the idea of a two-state solution is becoming a dangerous sort of way to go about things because of how it has been adopted by Israel and Israel's allies as a means of subverting Palestinian rights. Okay, who was the first American president to talk about a Palestinian state? Was it Jimmy Carter? Was it Jimmy Carter? No. Was it Bill Clinton? No. It was Bush Jr. Okay, so what's going to make someone like George Bush Jr. push for talk about a Palestinian state? Ariel Sharon, the war criminal, talked about a Palestinian state. And Netanyahu, but he's a bit of a different kind of category because he's also too ideologically blind to really know what's tactically smart. But even he, in the speech he made a couple of years ago, was kind of suggesting that there would be a Palestinian state. Tony Blair talks about a Palestinian state, and I include him in the same category as all the people before on purpose. Why are all these people talking about a Palestinian state or supporting a Palestinian, or they say they support a Palestinian state? Well, because what they have in mind are Bantustan-style reservations where a kind of autonomy is exercised by an obedient Palestinian leadership, while core Palestinian issues and core Palestinian rights, such as return, such as equality, such as decolonization, are thrown in the bin of history, okay? So this is why I mean the discussion about the two-state solution, it's moving in this direction, where it's actually being appropriated in order to subvert Palestinian rights, not advance them. Okay? I'm not talking about people's motivations. I know people advocate a two-state solution with the best intentions, right, and in a good framework. But I'm just kind of flagging up a problem and something that's happened reasonably recently. If you look at the rhetoric, for example, just to give one example before I move on, if you look at, I don't know how many people here have heard of BICOM, which is the main kind of pro-Israel advocacy group in the UK, the Britain-Israel Communications Centre, BICOM. Their platform and the messaging that they give to the media in their briefings is that they are pro a two-state solution, two states for two peoples. What is the logic of two states for two peoples? It's an apartheid logic. Okay, it's a logic of separation, quite literally. Okay? It's a logic that says, all right, we're going to have Jewish ethno-religious privilege in the majority of Palestine, and Palestinians can have their kind of autonomy or sovereignty in what's left. I mean, that's what two states for two peoples is saying. And Palestinian refugees, if they return anywhere, it's to this Bantustan authority that we've allowed to emerge. Okay. What? Going well so far. So I want to say two further kind of sections before concluding thoughts, which I'm going to call rethinking and reimagining. And despite the rain, I definitely need paper for this. So it'll just have to get wet. I don't know how many people have heard different summaries of the Palestinian struggle or the situation there. Do I want to move forward? Sure, why not? Let's do that. Thanks so much. Was that my reference to the rain and the paper? Great. Well, Garth, let's go. Let's have it. Okay. I'm tired of hearing things like, this is a tragic conflict between two sides that are locked in perpetual conflict, or, you know, this is not a war between Abraham's children. This is not neighbors who don't get on with each other. This is an anti-colonial, anti-apartheid struggle. And unless people are addressing in that way, they're not going to be getting to the root of how it started, how it's continued, and how ultimately it'll be resolved. Okay, so that's my first kind of rethinking point. How many people here have heard of the Green Line? Okay, pretty good. I don't really know why I asked you to put your hand up, because there was no way of distinguishing if there was anybody who hadn't. But in case there is anybody here who hadn't, the Green Line is, in theory, a border between the territory that Israel held before 1967 and after 1967. Within international law, it's quite important, because anything over the 67 Green Line is considered to be occupied territory. But what I want to say is that the Green Line should be considered invisible in two ways. Okay, or irrelevant in two ways. I'm putting aside for the moment, I'm kind of thinking about it theoretically, or thematically, I mean, not discounting its importance in international law, which is more important now for strategic reasons. Anyway, the reason why the Green Line is invisible. Number one, it's physically been rendered irrelevant by Israeli colonization policies. Okay, the Green Line doesn't exist from the point of view of the Israeli state when they're making planning decisions. If the tourism ministry is planning a trail for people to go hiking, the Green Line doesn't matter. Okay, it just goes around into the West Bank. If you're planning a road network or infrastructure, the Green Line doesn't exist. They just build it anyway. The major colonies, which in their language everybody knows will be part of Israel, okay, the Green Line doesn't exist. So in that sense, the Green Line is invisible. But so far, I don't think that's a particularly spectacularly original thing to say. I think most people understand that. The second way in which I think the Green Line has become invisible, which I think is more important for people to take on board, and it relates to how I introduced the talk in the first place, is that the Green Line is invisible because Israeli policies are taking place on both sides of the Green Line with the same purpose and often using very similar methods. This was brought home to me very kind of clearly in 2010, when in the summer, on a trip to Palestine, within the space of 2 days, two different things happened. One, in the Negev, Nakab, in the south, okay, so this is in real Israel, pre-67 Israel, the Israeli authorities demolished for the first time of what is now 30-plus times the unrecognized village of Al-Araqib. This village was demolished in the Negev, okay? The next day, I went to a community in the Jordan Valley who had just had major demolitions take place by the Israeli army of their property. In both cases, you've got Palestinians, one group with citizenship, one group without citizenship under military occupation, having their properties demolished, and alongside them are Jewish communities who are, in the case of the Negev, are planned, because that's why these properties are getting demolished. Or in the case of the Jordan Valley, the settlements already exist, like alongside these Palestinian communities that are getting demolished. And it's just a very strong image for you guys to bear in mind that if I was using PowerPoint, I would show you two photographs. Both photographs show Palestinians standing alongside the torn, ripped up metal and wood of their properties. And you would not be able to tell, looking at those pictures, which one had taken place inside Israel proper and inside the occupied West Bank. You wouldn't tell, because they look exactly the same, and a very similar thing has taken place. Interestingly, that connection between events on both sides of the Green Line was mentioned in two reports that came out this year. One, which I really, really, really recommend you look up when you go home online, which was by the UN's Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. It's not that long, but Israel was reported on, as every country is periodically. And this is the strongest report that the UN Committee for Elimination of Discrimination has ever issued on a country since the time of South Africa. And that assessment was given to me by an academic who specializes in advising that committee on issues to do with migrant workers. He said he'd never seen a stronger condemnation of a country's discriminatory segregation practices since the time of South Africa. And the whole practice of that UN committee, by the way, is to engage with the state in question, right? They don't want to just issue condemnations willy-nilly. They want to try and engage with the partner and improve practices, et cetera, et cetera. But that report by that committee in March, it was published in March, said, we are forced to remind the state party of the prohibition of the policies of apartheid. Okay? And the EU, in a more recent resolution that was passed by the European Parliament, made the link between the demolition of properties in the West Bank and the Negev too. So people are starting to get it, right? That there's not this, unlike the kind of liberal Zionist fantasy that everything evil occurs the other side of the Green Line in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip, actually people understand that the same sort of stuff is happening on both sides. We also need to rethink in order to move beyond the occupation discourse. Now that needs unpacking again to ensure that I'm not being misunderstood. I don't mean that we shouldn't talk about what's happening under Israeli military rule. The home demolitions, the wall, the siege on Gaza, the ability for the Israeli military to kill Palestinians with impunity. I don't mean that you shouldn't talk about that or use it in campaigning points or BDS points, etc. No. But what I mean is we have to put what's happening in the military occupation as part of a bigger context. Okay, it's one component in a bigger picture, what's happening in the occupied territories. It's not the thing. It's one component of a bigger picture. And that is very important for messaging and for discourse and for thinking about how the whole thing should be solved at all. And finally, the rethinking has to involve challenging the idea that it is in any way legitimate for Israel to be defined as a Jewish state. And that means getting to the real kind of heart of the issue and inevitably also the kind of issue that gets a lot of people annoyed, I mean to put it mildly, right? But why that's important is because all of the issues that we're talking about here, all of the ways of looking at it, will ultimately come back to the same question. Is it possible, is it sustainable, is it just to have a regime that privileges and benefits one group of people at the expense of another group of people? That's what it all, you can talk about everything till you're blue in the face, you can read a million think tank papers, and it will all come back down to that one single question, which until now has only been resolved in favor of maintaining that sort of discriminatory regime. Almost getting there. I want to talk about reimagining as well as rethinking. It's darn rain. So reimagining, a few points about reimagining. Reimagining to conceive of a future where there is genuine coexistence of equals. Coexistence, unfortunately, is a word that is exploited by those who don't want to see a change in the status quo. They want to see everybody quiet, and they don't want people to rock the boat, and that's their form of shallow coexistence. But actually, there is a form of coexistence that takes place after the dismantling of colonial power relations, and where it's possible to imagine Jews and Palestinians sharing the same space in real coexistence as equals. That kind of reimagining means a different understanding of self-determination, as is often understood, and particularly as is pushed by Zionists too, where it's you there and us here. Okay? It means an idea of self-determination that's not mutually exclusive. It's an idea of self-determination where two groups of people are actually expressing their self-determination in the same space and in the sharing of that same space. I'm going to read this directly because it's put beautifully and I don't want to get it wrong, but a website, actually you can see the website credited for the maps on one side of the handout. This website, talking about reimagining the future, put it like this. Instead of asking, can we return, Palestinian refugees ask, what kind of return do we want to create for ourselves? That's beautiful and empowering. And that's where the exciting work is being done. Okay, it's A lot of it's still in its infancy, but actually researching and envisaging and thinking about what does that mean? What does it mean for the Palestinian refugees to be physically returning? What does it mean to decolonize the different aspects of the regime? What does it mean to have shared space? And that sort of work is starting to happen in NGOs and some academics and activists and things like this. But it's still, I mean, that's still kind of in the beginning stage. But that's the direction it's going in. The final section that I have, which is quite lucky because the paper is basically about to disintegrate, is a section on resistance. And by that, I'm talking about our resistance. And I want to mention three lessons from Martin Luther King, right? You're bound to win if you reference Martin Luther King, right? So, but I want to mention three lessons from Martin Luther King. The first one is one that many people are familiar with. And that was what he was, in his writings and his campaigning, he was, everything was based around the fact that the oppressors, the powerful, do not surrender that position voluntarily, that it has to be forced in some way. A second lesson that I think is applicable from Martin Luther King here is that envisaging, like being radically brutal about what it is now and envisaging a decolonized future is also a message of hope for Jewish Israelis too. Because what it's saying is that it's possible for Jewish people to be in that land thriving religiously, culturally, etc., but not in a position of dominance that, thankfully, many more of them will tell you, is corrupting for their society itself. And that's exactly what Martin Luther King was telling white Americans too. He was saying that my message for you is also hope for you, okay? Ultimately speaking, that's what the vision is. And the third lesson that I want to mention from Martin Luther King in this issue, and I find myself coming back to this time and time again, read if you haven't read it, or reread it if you read it a while ago, Letter from a Birmingham Jail. And the third lesson from Martin Luther King is that sadly, often the biggest obstacle to radical change is not the right-wing extremist, but white liberals. And I'm sure there's none of those here at Greenbelt, so that's fine. But the reason why that is the case is because in Martin Luther King's experience, they were telling him, oh, you need to go a bit slower, you sound a bit extreme, you know, can't we do things at a kind of reduced pace, all that sort of stuff. And he said, who are you to tell African Americans in this case, who are you to tell the Palestinians how quick or slow their path to liberation must be, okay? So those are lessons from Martin Luther King that I think are relevant to our resistance and our activities here in the West. I just want to mention and emphasize the importance of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions strategy, which was called for by Palestinians back in 2005 now, and which in 7 years has seen an extraordinary amount of growth on campuses, amongst university faculty, in trade unions, amongst cooperative supermarkets, etc., across the board, amongst artists who are agreeing to cultural boycott. It's very important, these strategies, as a means of empowering people here to take part in activities that make a difference, in answering the call of the colonized people for help, because it's not possible, the Palestinians know it's not possible for liberation to come without the outside assistance. And I just want to mention that two things that I've said, well, actually pretty much everything I've said, produces some sort of backlash or anger in some quarters, right? But particularly when you go to the heart of Israel's identity as a Jewish state and also advocating and pushing strategies like BDS. That backlash is to be expected, it's normal, and not that it's not serious in some cases, but you just have to get on with it, basically. And an extra dimension, if anybody here, or maybe lots of people here, are people who are part of a church or some sort of Christian community, another aspect that is used by Israel's defenders against people who are trying to take part in activities in defense of Palestinian rights, apart from the accusation of anti-Semitism, is a slightly different one, which is to say that you are compromising or damaging interfaith relations. Okay? Now, this is used has been used to varying degrees of success across the board every time a mainstream church denomination tries to advance anything to do with BDS or supporting Palestinian rights. Happens in the UK, happens in Canada, happens in the US, happens in Australia. The same thing will happen, that pro-Israel Jewish communal bodies will say that it is damaging interfaith relations for that particular church to, say, boycott settlement goods, that kind of thing. And it's just something that you have to be aware of and to respond appropriately, right? And to point out that it's not accurate to say that the Jewish community speaks with one voice on this issue, that there are Jewish people involved in every single Palestine solidarity movement across the West, many of them, you know, kind of some of the key engines and driving forces behind these groups, who are saying that, no, that's not actually what I feel as a Jewish person in solidarity with Palestine. And just quickly, I mean, I'm sure many of you saw what happened in the case of the Church of England Synod ending up voting to support a motion, a very moderate motion, that included an endorsement of the EAPPI program. And the same strategies were used in the run-up to that, right up to the vote itself. The Church of England, if it supports EAPPI, it's unbalanced, it's damaging interfaith relations, et cetera, et cetera. And it passed because, in my opinion, why did that change? Why did that pass now? It passed because the motion was very reasoned and kind of careful to be supportive. I mean, not crazy or radical or anything like that. It's passed because more people know now about the reality that's happening inside the occupied Palestinian territories that EAPPI volunteers are witnessing and reporting about. And it also worked, and it passed, because many Jewish voices, including from Israel, said, we thoroughly support the work of EAPPI and we thoroughly support this motion. And it is not correct to say that you're somehow destroying or damaging relations with Jews by supporting Palestinian rights. Right, I've literally no idea how long I've just gone on for, so I'm going to wrap it up to have a time for questions. Garth, what time is it actually? Yeah? Sure. Okay, great. That's worked out quite well. It's like I've done this before. Okay, I'm going to finish off with two quotations. This first quotation is by the father of Moshe Dayan. I'm sure many of you will have heard of Moshe Dayan, the Israeli general. His father was a member of the first Israeli Knesset, okay, the first Israeli parliament that happened after 48. And in 1950, Moshe Dayan's father, Shmuel Dayan, he said this. I'll just read it anyway. Maybe not allowing the refugees back is not right and not moral, but if we become just and moral, I do not know where we will end up. Now, that was 1950. In 2012, there is a response to that question that doesn't have to be a response of fear and of building walls and of entrenchment and of exclusivity and of privilege. Instead, you can take the sort of approach advocated by the late, great Edward Said, who said this: coexistence, sharing, and community must win out over exclusivism, intransigence, and rejectionism. And there really is no time to lose. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Ben. And we've got a bit of time for questions. And I think the best way to do it is come on down. I think that's the best thing. Form an orderly queue. And then it's easiest, because this is the one mic we've got, really. So come and use this mic. And let's start off taking one question at a time. But if we find the queue is too long, we'll take a couple at a time.
Thanks for that, Ben. You must be frozen, poor chap. Okay. There's an organization which I came across a few years ago, known as One Voice, which claims to be a grassroots organization with supporters from both Israel and from Palestinian communities, working a lot with, particularly with young people and in universities. Its key policy is the advocation of the two-state solution, and as far as I know, that's still the case. What do you know of this organization, and what do you think of what it does? I mean, I was very impressed with the way it brings people together and the way it is it enables discussion.
I'll say something specifically about One Voice and then something that kind of like a broader point. As it happens, for the sake of clarity, the first ever article that I actually wrote for The Guardian's Comment is Free was specifically criticising an event organised by One Voice, as it happens. So it was quite an interesting question to get. The problem that I and other people see with One Voice is a lot of its premises from the kind of main premise that it has, which is that the key speaking now in paraphrasing their language and their framing, that the key obstacle to peace is that extremists are on both sides are stopping the moderate majority on both sides from reaching agreement. Like, that's the kind of discourse that they are promoting. Now, you can hopefully see the difference between that sort of base beginning analysis and what I'm saying is actually happening. Okay, it's a very different starting positions. Okay, problematic on all sorts of levels, to do with power inequalities, to do with actually what's really happening, what's the main engine driving, etc., etc. So, like, that's a kind of initial start off problem that I would have with One Voice. I don't want to go into too many specifics on them. I mean, I can, we can do it on email or something like that. But I wanted to make a point that's a bit bigger, because you finished by saying you were quite impressed by the way that they were bringing people together and this sort of thing. And sometimes, I guess I can put it like this. Sometimes people like me are accused of being an extremist you raise your eyebrows. I'm pretty sure that was sarcastic. But the point is, this position, talking about how it really is not anti people working together. It's not against coexistence. What it's saying is there has to be co-resistance to what's happening. Every single week, Jews and Palestinians are together facing off with the Israeli army in West Bank villages. Okay, that's really bringing people together with something meaningful, because it's first of all, it's Palestinians taking the lead. And secondly, it's Jewish Israelis coming alongside them to work with them to remove what really is the main obstacle, which is the system of apartheid that exists. So it's not that bringing people together per se is somehow bad, but it's all about the framework in which it's occurring and to what end, if it makes sense.
Thank you very much, Ben. My question really is, and it's more just a response to this comment, is you said about how now is the time to start advocating one state solution, and now is when the two state solution can no longer be sustainable from the situation on the ground, which I completely agree with. But my issue is the word now. I mean, one of the issues with Camp David was that the proposed two state solution was just unviable for a Palestinian state. It was already being in pockets of Palestinian for Palestinian areas, and that in itself was unsustainable. So what has happened the last 15 years? Why has it not been since then, when it was already unsustainable? And secondly, in the list of all the people who you mentioned who are sort of standing out for or mentioning a Palestinian state and talking about the two-state solution, interestingly, also very recently, Norman Finkelstein has written a book called The Solution to the Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, or something like that, and he completely advocates the two-state solution. So why is this still being proposed by academics who have always fought for the Palestinian rights, and why was it not 15 years ago? Why is it now, and it hasn't been before as such?
Well, of course, the idea of a one-state solution is not new itself. I mean, people forget, for example, that when the UN... back before 48, when the UN proposed partition, the minority report of the same committee recommended a one-state solution for it that was not adopted in favor of the majority report. And many Palestinians have stayed true to an old PLO framework of it being one secular state for Jews and Palestinians. It's not like the idea itself is new. But I guess what I mean by saying, emphasizing the now, is in terms of trying to to tap into and capitalize on what increasing numbers of people are realizing based on practical observations. Okay, so in other words, people who might otherwise not have thought to talk about the one-state solution are now. I mean, I haven't done a scientific survey of this, but I'm sure that if you did a search for how often it was mentioned in newspaper op-eds or analysis pieces of the last few years, you would see an uptick. So I guess what I mean is, it's a moment for people to really understand what that means, and that as a framework for solving it, rather than whether it would have been appropriate, as you mentioned, like 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 60 years ago. And there's a lot of reasons why many people still support the idea of a two-state solution for a lot of different reasons. And I mean, I have more or less sympathy for different kind of motivations for that. You know, I mean, obviously, the two-state solution is supported by Zionists, by people who want Israel to remain a Jewish state because they see it as being necessary to basically lose a few million Palestinians into a Palestinian state. There are many Palestinians, especially on the ground, who still support the idea of a two-state solution for a lot of different reasons, because of the history of the way the Palestinian national movement developed, because of what's happened in the last 20 years, whereby the Palestinian Authority and the entire idea of building a state is now sustaining people's livelihoods, and it's been the whole framework that many people have grown up in. So again, it's not, you don't just kind of ditch something like that overnight. That's why you'll find Palestinian leaders now from the West Bank saying something like, you know, speaking cagely about it. Okay, in other words, we think this is probably where it's going, but it's unlikely that many of them would say that right now for a lot of different reasons. And obviously the international community, it's been its whole framework. People have based their entire kind of diplomatic careers on pushing one particular option. Obviously the relationship to Israel is important on that point of view too. I don't really feel like going into the specifics of why, of Norman Finkelstein's position, but effectively, if you want to look at it from the point of view of analysis, one of his key points, which I disagree with, is that if it's that difficult to get Israel to create a Palestinian state, imagine how difficult it would be to make a one state. Like, that's a big part of his position. And my response to that kind of argument is to say, you are as equally unlikely to get a genuine Palestinian state emerge as you are to get a one state, because both options are rejected by Israel from the point of view of maintaining a regime of privilege. So that's kind of, I guess, an analytical difference. Okay.
I'll be short because I don't want to get too wet. I've heard from the Israeli side an argument for rejection of the return of Palestinian refugees, that there just isn't enough room, which is maybe deliberate policy, as they've allowed any Jewish people to immigrate as much as they want. But surely, haven't they got a point? If we're going to allow one state and allow all the Palestinian refugees to return, don't we have to get rid of some of the Israelis? Especially on things like water resources and things like that.
Yeah, so the kind of practical question about this, I mean, first of all, I have never heard anybody say or argue that it is impossible for the Palestinian refugees to physically return because of space, without that person also being ideologically opposed to it in the first place. Okay, the practical questions are the ones that I was mentioning are now starting to get genuinely looked at. One Palestinian academic who's looked at this for a very long time, Salman Abu Sitta, for example, the work he's done is based on the premise that it is very feasible in terms of space, and it just depends how you look at how you arrange, you know, cities and communities, and the fact that there is still a lot of empty space within the pre-67 borders, etc., etc. It's also important to remember that it's unlikely that all of the Palestinian refugees would decide to move to live in Palestine, right? Many of them have settled down in completely, you know, in Canada, in the States, in Europe. But the point is, at the moment, they're excluded from the option of even considering it or even visiting it on a racist basis. So the idea of whether it would be possible to do it, I think I would say it is possible to do it. And the exciting work I was referring to is where people are starting to look at, let's say, for example, Israel demolished 400 villages, 400 plus villages in 48. Well, obviously, no one's going to go back and live in villages that no longer exist. But I saw some work being done on how would you, by architects, by Palestinian architects, working on the idea of how would you actually create new communities that are kind of culturally, nationally appropriate and relevant to returning groups of refugees. And that whole issue is something that is going to, in my mind, only get more important to work out in terms of the fine detail. Oh, just before I stop this answer, I just wanted to mention something that I always try and mention if I remember it, because it's so amazing. If you go on YouTube and look up a video that's made by a Jewish Israeli NGO called Zochrot, which means remembrance in Hebrew, and their whole kind of reason for existing is to educate the Jewish Israeli public about the Nakba, about the ethnic cleansing of 48. They made a video called What Will You Do on the Day the Refugees Return? And they went around and interviewed, like Vox Pop style, Jewish Israelis, not beginning with that question, because that probably wouldn't have been sensible, but leading up to it through a different series of questions, and asking them, what will you do on the day the Palestinian refugees return? And some of the replies, especially from the younger ones, are amazing. Like one of them says, that's great, then we'll become a normal country. Another one says, I hope they invite me around for tea. You know, like not flippantly, like genuinely. So it's not impossible, and it's just like all of these things, a question of will and making it happen.
Yeah, I would love to debate some of these points more with you, but one thing that I just wanted to raise in terms that you touched upon is the attempts by Israel advocates in this country to control the parameters of the debate. Who's allowed to speak and what they're allowed to say. Now, for example, I work for Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and we campaign on international law and human rights and justice, and we don't actually advocate for a one-state or a two-state solution, but there have been attempts to call us anti-two-state solution because we don't actively advocate for it, as an attempt to sort of sideline us in terms of the debate and say that we shouldn't have the right to kind of participate. That's obviously quite an extreme view, but as far as I can see, the best answer to that is, well, who is actually destroying any chances of the two-state solution? It's actually the Israeli state. PSC in the last year hasn't built a single settlement. We haven't demolished a single village. We haven't done any of those things. So the people who are responsible, who people want to criticize for destroying the chances of a two-state solution, are not groups like mine, but actually the Israeli state, and it's kind of removing the focus from those. And they've similarly tried to silence all types of advocates, and when you become more involved in this, you see that going on. There's also an attempt to silence politicians who might say, in a terms of thought police, about saying that if you don't stand up for a two-state solution, and if you support a one-state solution, it's some sort of thought crime. You know, it's just not allowed. It's also this push to go from people have sort of said, yes, I accept the right of an Israeli state. It's said, but do you accept the right of a Jewish state? And obviously that's very difficult for Palestinians because there are fellow Palestinians living within the state of Israel. What I wanted to ask you, Ben, is how we wrestle back control of that debate, how we set the parameters, put the difficult questions, and how we keep that freedom for all of these variety of voices to keep speaking out and to not have their legitimacy reduced.
So I just had a brief moment there where I just thought that what I was doing was totally insane, like standing in the driving rain in front of people sitting on a grandstand. This is actually a very complicated issue, and it kind of, I guess what I want to say is that different people need to do different things, okay? So the reason why I mentioned something when I was talking about the invisible green line that I didn't really elaborate on and might have been a bit confusing, but I said it's very important still, strategically. And what I mean by that is, because the way that international law is set up, all of the West Bank settlements are considered illegal, The Green Line is very relevant from the point of view of different boycott and divestment initiatives, okay? Because you can go to a particular, whatever, supermarket or what have you, and say, you know, these products are from settlements that are illegal under international law. I don't realistically expect a MP who has got involved in Palestine solidarity work to tomorrow go in front of a microphone and advocate a one-state solution, right? I don't expect that to happen. For the moment, that's okay. But what I mean is there's going to be people who are... Some people are going to be pushing the boundaries of the discourse, and other people are going to be working within parameters that already exist. And on some occasions, there will be a direct conflict, but I don't think that has to be very often, because I think it has to be a question of looking at who's doing what, for what reasons, and making sure that one is taking a sensible strategic approach, with the common framework being that everybody is interested in making sure that Palestinians have all of their rights respected and implemented. And I think that kind of way of looking at it is a pretty important way of thinking about narrative and activism in a place like the UK. You know, one group that advocates total BDS and a one-state solution is doing stuff that maybe another person or another group can't do, and maybe can't do for, you know, for sensible reasons. So it's just a question of making sure that people don't get too stressed about some of these different people doing different stuff issue, and as long as it's clear that in solidarity you're responding to what the colonized people are asking for and are advocating for their rights, then I think it will be negotiable. Last question.
Ben, thank you for bringing such clarity to what can often seem such a foggy situation. I wonder if you would mind commenting on the possibility of a military attack on Iran, and in the context of the wider picture of the West softening up Iran through Syria, and the attack on Iran being an opportunity to have a lot more Arabs killed around the place and establish greater hegemony by Israel and the West over the Arab stroke Islamic world?
Well, in a way, this answer could be very short because, I mean, in short, I don't know. And what I don't know about, and I really don't know about this, and I'm not sure many people really do know about it, whether it will or won't happen, is what I mean. I'm genuinely not sure. Like, I'll read one thing one day and think, yeah, that's a pretty good argument for it going to happen. And the next day I'll read something and I think, yeah, that's a pretty good argument that it won't happen. And I think that's... And of course, you could make a third argument, which is that is exactly what is the idea, to make sure nobody quite sure if it will happen or not. Obviously, the whole debate is, like, with an Israeli-centric perspective, the discourse being that Iran is the one introducing, if it is, nuclear weapons into the Middle East, when, of course, Israel already has them. And, you know, Iran is not occupying anybody else, etc. So, I mean, obviously, it's pretty easy to dismantle the discourse from that point of view. It's a bit of a big question or answer to look at it like as a whole region. But I mean, in terms of, that is clearly priority number one for Netanyahu. I mean, that's pretty obvious. If it was only down to Netanyahu, for sure there would be an attack on Iran. The question is whether the arguments against the attack on Iran that are being voiced by important members of the Israeli security political establishment for their own reasons, whether those will be outweigh, ultimately, Netanyahu's position and the people who support his position. If it was just him, yes, but there's a lot of Israeli military security leaders who have got big credibility in terms of the establishment who don't think it's a smart move. So yeah, sorry I can't give a kind of, I haven't been told whether it will happen, but I think keeping everybody guessing is probably at least part of the idea. Just say, before I finish, maybe you're about to say this anyway, but there should be, and I'm going to go there, whether there is or not, copies of my books in the G Books tent, and I'm going to go and sit at a table. So if you want to buy one and watch me sign it in front of you, then you can do that in the tent.
Thank you very much, Ben. It's tremendous. Thank you. Appreciate your clarification. And let's just show our appreciation that he would stand here in the pouring rain for our sakes.